farmer returning home from World War II could make a living, a good living, pay the bills, and send the children to college by farming 100 acres of tomatoes. But then along came the mechanical tomato harvester. Today, that farmer would need over 2,500 acres of tomatoes just to make the same good living he could have made on 100 acres after World War II. This leads one to ask, is bigger better?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 546th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Alangapo who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones. Hello, Carol.
Hello.
And Parmley Taff on the sales. Hello, Parmley.
Good morning.
Folks, there has been a tremendous consolidation in our food chain that has taken you and I farther and farther away from the source of our food. Where our food once came from our own farm or that of a neighbor down the road, it has now likely comes from a giant corporation thousands of miles away. Some say this new way of procuring food is a great thing because it allows us more time to hang around the city and, well, shuffle papers for one another. Others look at the tremendous distance involved and become concerned about the efficacy of foods from far away. Today we pause to ask, is this bigger way of producing food a better way? And coming into the studio to help us out, we have Professor William Friedland, who is a professor emeritus of sociology at University of California, Santa Cruz. Well, Professor Friedland is really the developer of the field of rural sociology, of the study of people in rural areas, and his collected work now consumes 16 linear feet of the University of California's Special Collections Library. So a substantial amount of work that Professor Friedland is devoted into studying the sociology of rural communities. And when he arrives at the studio here today, we're going to be talking with him about the impact of getting big on rural communities and what impact that has had. But as we wait for him, I thought what we'd do today is talk a little bit about where it all starts, and that is the pursuit of economies of scale. The bigger you get, the less expensive things are to get that way. So to illustrate this, I have called on my two able assistants, Carol Stafford and Parmley Taff here, and to illustrate what economies of scale are. So let's say that that producer Carol and producer Parmley are both going to go into the business of farming, and they're going to go out and buy a $10,000 tractor. Now, Carol's tractor is going to be used on her one-acre farm, and Parmley's tractor is going to be used on her 100-acre farm. So the question that we're putting on the table today is, how much does each person's $10,000 tractor cost? Carol, you've got 1 acre. How much is your tractor?
I don't know. How much does a tractor cost?
Yeah, it's going to cost you $10,000, right?
Oh, I guess so.
You have 1 acre. Okay. Parmley, how much is your $10,000 tractor going to cost if you have 100 acres?
Well, I'm going to be able to spread it out over a greater profit, I think.
Right. So your tractor is going to cost you $100 an acre, and Carol's tractor is going to cost $10,000 per acre because she has 1 acre. And that is what the economies of scale are. Verstehen Sie nicht?
Yeah.
So there we are, folks, the economies of scale. So the objective has always been to pursue those economies of scale and develop more efficiencies as we grow larger. And that is probably the reason that we often heard through the years of the past few decades that farmers should get big or get out. And as a consequence, farmers have gotten big and have gotten out. Now, there's been a real interesting economies of scale study conducted by the University of California on the processing tomato industry here in California. So this really illustrates the impact this pursuit of economies has had on the development of rural communities and the way we grow our food. After World War II, as I said in the introduction to this program, a farmer coming home from World War II could make a good living. That is to say, he or she could have paid all of their bills, could have sent their children to college, and had a good life by farming 100 acres of processing tomatoes. But by 1960, that pursuit of economies of scale meant that by 1960, that same farmer would have needed 800 acres to earn the same good living. By 1970, that farmer would have needed 2,500 acres. By 1990, farmers were going broke, farming 10,000 acres of processing tomatoes. And today, of course, processing tomatoes are moving offshore to Mexico and other countries. So what happened to the rural communities that grew those tomatoes? What happened to the farmers who used to live in those communities? In 1963, California had 4,000 people growing tomatoes. There are 4,000 tomato farms. In 1973, that number had fallen to 597 tomato farmers. So, boom, today probably we have very, very few farms growing processing tomatoes. So what happened to all of the people? What happened to the tomato farmers? What happened to the people who were picking tomatoes? What happened to the rural communities that was supported by those tomato farms? And I think they have all disappeared pretty much, and that's the subject of today's show, is bigger, better, and we see Professor just pulled into the parking lot, so we'll be able to work with him in a minute. And this leads me to a very interesting observation. Several years ago, I was doing a radio show in South Dakota, and I got lost and was looking for directions, and I pulled into a farm. And out of the barn came this young man, a handsome young man. He was wearing boots from walking in the dairy barn, you know, and obviously had been working very hard. His face was flushed, but his eyes were clear. His smile was bright. His countenance was honest and forthright. And I looked at that, and later I got to wondering where on earth my daughter would find a person with that honesty, with that ability to do hard work. And so that's part of what we're going to be looking with a good professor today. His name is Professor William Friedland. He is a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He is well known for his work at the impact on mechanical tomato harvesters, and here he is. So we'll be welcoming him to the studio, and we'll be talking a little bit about the impact of size on rural communities. Professor Friedland, welcome aboard. You'll have to step up here and share this microphone with me today. We have a little mechanical difficulties, but I'm honored.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. I apologize for traffic, etc.
No problem, we're here. I just kind of gave a brief introduction about the whole pursuit of economies of scale and its impact on the rural communities of our country. But before we go on, I'd like to ask you a quick question, Professor. I know that some of my audience is going to be wondering, what business does a sociologist have in the industry of agriculture?
Well, most people that work in the area of agriculture and have a scientific orientation one way or another are essentially what we call technical people. They're horticulturalists or agronomists and people like that. But relatively few of us are interested in, so to speak, how it all gets put together as a package so that when a tomato is grown on a farm, it turns up in Toronto, Canada, And somehow or other, between the farm and Toronto, Canada, there are a lot of people and there's a lot of organization. And that's where sociologists come into the picture.
Well, we are talking a little bit about, we have about a minute left before we have to go to the break, but in brief, what happened to all of those communities out there in the California Central Valley that were growing tomatoes?
Well, the real answer to that is we don't know. And the reason for that is that there's not much study that goes into, not much research. And there's not much research funding that goes into that kind of analysis. What we do know is that in other parts of the country where this process has taken place, particularly in the Midwest, communities just literally dry up, shrivel up, and go away.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Professor William Friedland. He was a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Honored to have him aboard today. His work is well known throughout the ag community, and we look forward to a great conversation with him today. You can participate, 831-4790 or 800-624-2665. Right back. Please do stay tuned. Welcome back out there. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. Today we're talking with Professor William Friedland, who is a professor emeritus of sociology at UC Santa Cruz. Professor Friedland is well known throughout the ag community for his studies about the impact of the mechanical tomato harvester. So let's start there. Professor Friedland, we got the notion, I guess, a lot of the reason we did the mechanical tomato harvester was to overcome the problems with immigrant labor. Was that not true?
That was definitely a key motivating factor. At that time, most of the workers working in harvesting tomatoes were braceros. That is to say, imported under a legislation that was agreed upon between Mexico and the United States. And that was introduced during World War II, but kept on going after the war ended. But as it did, different people complained about it, and eventually it was ended in 1964. Now, when it was ended, the result was that, or before it was ended, in anticipation thereof, research got underway both to have a tomato that would be machine harvested, because those tomatoes did not exist, and a machine that could harvest those tomatoes. And that research was done up at Davis, at the University of California, Davis.
Well, Professor Friedland, you did a lot of work with respect to the consequence or the result of this mechanical harvester. What did you see?
Well, the most dramatic results were that the number of tomato growers in California went from approximately 4,000 to 600. And this happened in a period of about 8 or 9 years. That was one of the most rapid transformations or mechanizations of any agricultural commodity at any time historically. So that was one dramatic consequence. A second one was that we went from approximately 50,000 tomato workers to about 18,000, and then when there was a second generation of technological change introduced, it went to 12,000. So in other words, the number of workers changed. But there are a number of other consequences. For example, the center of tomato production shifted from around the Stockton area to down around the Fresno area.
Why was that?
That was because with the machine, you could harvest larger acreages. The water had come in with the California Water Project, particularly on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. And so that you had these very large acreages that could handle those tomatoes. Now, what that meant was that workers had to be found down around the Fresno area, and that also meant the feminization of the labor force.
Why the feminization? How does that work?
Well, the way it worked was that most workers before mechanization were males and were braceros. But when the bracero program ended and the shift took place geographically to the south, Then they had to find new workers because the braceros weren't available. And in that sense, what they had to do was go out and find workers who weren't really working, and a lot of them were wives of existing farm workers who now either entered or re-entered the labor market. And that led to the feminization process.
How did that change the rural landscape of California?
Well, that's kind of hard to say because all I have is impressions. It's not been the subject of continual research. This kind of research has not been encouraged in California.
And professors like numbers, right?
Professors like numbers because numbers are more convincing arguments than non-numbers. If I say something and I don't have numbers, then people say, how do you know? And ultimately that means you better do some counting.
Okay, good. Let's talk a little bit about the impact of this pursuit of the it's not just the tomato harvester, is it?
No. As a matter of fact, at that time, both the state legislature and the university were committed to getting as many agricultural crops mechanized as possible. So a lot of research was going on, some of which was just wasted money because it simply didn't work. But the commitment to this kind of orientation is a long-standing historical commitment that we've had in the United States. And it's part of this urge to get bigger and bigger, which is not a, surprisingly enough, a pattern that is found even in other places where you have very, very modern, highly technical agricultural systems, such as in the Netherlands.
Well, Professor, isn't it the job of the agricultural business person to pursue those economies, to develop ways of getting the most from the least so that you can generate a return on your investment so that you can continue farming into the future?
Well, it's not clear that that actually gets you the most for the least investment. In the Netherlands, for example, there are highly productive tomato farms, not just tomatoes, but they grow all kinds of tomatoes. As a matter of fact, some of those Dutch tomatoes turn up here in Santa Cruz at Trader Joe's. They're imported from Holland. And they've gotten here all that distance, and obviously at a price that is not only reasonable for the consumer, but produces an income for tomato growers in the Netherlands.
Well, how do you describe the existence of these two broadly divergent ways of doing things, then?
Well, I think the key factor is what government policy is. What the state... I'm talking about the nation now. What the nation does and says about how it wants to treat agriculture has a critical influence in the question of size. So the fact that you have literally hundreds, if not thousands, of these small 4.5-acre glass house farms in the Netherlands producing tomatoes and eggplant and all kinds of other crops that are exported all over the world, that's an artifact of government policy. And what that says is that in the Netherlands, the government says, we want to keep a large number of people on the land, and we want to have them to be economically viable. And these are people that are making their living, and it's a perfectly good living. What they're not doing is getting bigger and bigger and richer, but they make a good living, and they are quite happy, apparently, with what they do.
And this is not to say that those farmers in Holland are technologically backward, is it?
No, as a matter of fact, the degree of technological sophistication that I saw on a very brief visit in the glasshouse area in the Netherlands is really quite remarkable. It's remarkable not only in a technical sense, but in a sociological sense. That is to say, to fertilize the tomatoes. They have access to bumblebees that come in packages and that are hung up at the right moment. And these bumblebees go around buzzing on the tomato flowers and fertilizing. If there's a technical problem with some kind of disease, then what happens is that the tomato grower calls the extension person, and the extension person finds a technical specialist to visit that grower and tell him what the nature of the problem is and what to do about it. So technologically, this is very sophisticated. But in a sociological sense, it's also sophisticated, because what happens is the tomato growers send, they have organized themselves, and they send delegations of other growers to visit tomato growers on a regular schedule and ask, what is it that these growers do? To take them through the process and to point out their own experiences, that is to say, the inspectors.
They're like bumblebees, aren't they?
They're just like bumblebees. They're fertilizing ideas.
Folks, class is in session. We have Professor William Friedland from the University of California, Santa Cruz. Are we having fun? And you're invited to participate. Just pick up your phone and join us today and talk with the professor and ask anything you want, because this man has been around and knows pretty much everything. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back with Professor Friedland. Do stay tuned. Hey, we're back. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain, this Saturday morning program that, where we deal with what's eating what up and down the food chain. And today we're talking a little bit about what happened when agriculture went after the economies of scale and how production kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And what happened with our pursuit of those economies to the economies of rural communities. With us today, we have Professor William Friedland, who is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of California. And we're working with you as well. Our phone number is today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Professor Friedland, before we go to the phones, could you tell us what happened to those people in the heartlands when their communities kind of just dried up and got blown away? And where did those people go?
Well, like most people in the transition from agriculture to industry, they go to the cities, and they become urban residents. At various times, sporadically, this, because I haven't done systematic research on this, I've run across people like this. And sometimes they're happy about that transition, because agriculture is not an easy job to do. It takes time and it takes a lot of energy. But very often I've met people that, I mean, I remember dramatically once at a hearing, a congressional hearing, one of these people was talking to me and he started crying. He literally started crying, because his family had come from an agricultural background. He grew up on the farm. He knew it was hard work. And now he's driving a bus. And he wasn't very, very happy about it. Now, that's about the best I can say about that. There's a lot of literature on individuals, but as far as the communities go, there are several books. But one of the things that's become clear in the Midwest is that the Midwest is becoming almost a human desert in various places. And that's why about a decade ago, a couple of scientists, I believe, made a proposal to put the land back under buffaloes. In other words, to take part of that Midwest where the buffalo roamed and give it back to the buffaloes.
Yeah, and we're going to go to the phones right now, folks. That phone numbers are 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Let's go to Jim. Jim, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Jim. I wanted to make sure we're comparing apples and apples, or tomatoes and tomatoes here, because, you know, there are a lot of different kinds of tomato markets. And, like, for instance, you have what we call the greens, which are the fresh tomatoes. They're picked by hand. And we have the greenhouse tomatoes. There's a pretty big hothouse tomato market in this country. It's grown in this country. And then you have your cannery tomatoes. And you can't compare the cannery tomatoes to the carriage trade tomatoes that are coming out of Holland.
It's almost apples and oranges, but not quite.
Here's what my question is. Are there any cannery tomatoes that are competitively being grown and shipped out of Holland?
Not to my knowledge, because Holland is a very, very small country, and it wouldn't make sense to allocate land for what is essentially what people nowadays call a commodity.
Well, my point is that you're using Holland as a false example.
No.
Thank you very much. I'll see you.
Okay, well, this is not a false example. This is an example of talking about one segment of tomatoes, and that is tomatoes for the fresh market. Fresh market tomatoes are quite different from tomatoes that go to processing. So while I may use that that example of tiny farms, four and a half acres, I'm not trying to compare that with processing tomatoes, but then I would have to go to Italy, because there in Italy we have a lot of processing tomatoes being produced, and these are being produced on very relatively small acreages by comparison to the United States.
So the comparison will hold true. You know what I noticed, Professor, when I wrote Metro Farm, it seemed to be that there were two kinds of farms, farms that were getting very, very big and farms that were getting very, very small. Kind of everything in the middle was roadkill. But the farms that were getting very, very big were those farms who were growing commodities for the international commodity market, which, of course, would be the like processing tomatoes. But the farms who were doing well and staying very, very small were like those farms you were talking about in Holland that were growing very high-end specialty tomatoes for the gourmet market. So there seems to be two different worlds of two different kinds of food being grown and processed there. Does that make any sense?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, this goes on all the time. One of the things you have to get clear in mind is that if you're talking about different kinds of products, different kinds of commodities, they themselves, the commodities themselves, impose a spatial limit. So that, for example, tomatoes can be grown in very big acreages or relatively small acreages. But if you compare tomatoes, whether fresh market or processing, to, let's say, strawberries. Strawberries are on a very different scale and a much smaller scale. One of my colleagues, for example, who grew up in California, his father was a 10-acre strawberry grower, put all of the kids in the family, and I've forgotten how many kids there were, but quite a few, put all of the kids through the University of California or some other colleges on 10 acres. 10 acres. Now, nowadays, 10 acres of strawberries is considered minuscule. But on the other hand, I have never yet heard of a strawberry farm of 1,000 acres. Whereas in tomatoes, that's not only normal, but required. Right. So you get these different scales that are, imposed by the character of the crop.
Does not the same kind of basic principle hold still? You know, if you're growing commodity strawberries, if you're growing for a real large organization, chances are that you're going to need a lot of strawberry plants to make a living in there. But if you're growing just for a specialty local market, then you can probably survive by being much smaller.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, what organic production encouraged was either the maintenance of or the entry into production of relatively small acreages aimed at local production. And that has worked fairly well. Now what's happening is this process of getting bigger in organics is also taking place.
Well, a lot of work that you've been doing recently has been toward the looking at the globalization of the food chain. So after this break, we're going to take a quick break, a quick look at how the pursuit of bigness has led to the globalization of the food chain and the consequences for those of us who happen to eat food. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Professor William Friedland, University of California, Santa Cruz, Professor Emeritus of Sociology. And I guess we're talking about the impact of food and the way we grow food on people. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phone and join us, and we will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about the direction of agriculture, how we've gone from little to very, very big, and in our pursuit of economies of scale, and how there seems to be two directions, and one of them is pursuing the very, very big, and the other is kind of very, very small. Professor Friedland, with respect to, you talked a little bit earlier about how the government really provides direction. You know, I sometimes think of the government as being the gatekeeper at a big dam, you know, and when it wants things to green up, it lets the water out, and when it wants things to dry up, it turns the water off. What does the government do to really provide for the direction of its agriculture?
Well, for example, if you look back in the early days of the development of American agriculture, this is right after the Civil War, approximately. What you find is that as the West began to open, there was a question of how do you people the land? And the tendency of the government was to follow the lines of the meridians and the latitudes and the longitudes, which gives you then, so to speak, rectangular shapes. And that was built into the Homestead Act, which was, I think, 1862, where if you settled on a piece of land and lived there for, I believe it was 7 years, I've forgotten the number of years, and developed that land.
And proved up.
Proved it. Then you were given that land, or you had to pay a reasonable, very, very low price, and that was intended to settle people on the land. Now, that worked well in some areas of the United States, but as you move further west, you got into the arid zones, and there, if you just allocated 160 acres, it was really insufficient.
Enough for two cows, you know, grazing at 10 miles an hour to
That's
survive.
That's right. And what's interesting, I just recently read a book by Wallace Stegner called Beyond the 100th Meridian, which dealt with this issue. And this book was centered around John Wesley Powell, the guy who led the first exploration down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon, who later on became the head of the Geological Survey. And he studied the West intensively. And one of the things he said was, we shouldn't use these rectangular shapes because it has
nothing to do with anything out here.
That's right.
It worked well for Iowa?
That's right. It worked well for places like Iowa, but as you got closer to the Rockies and then beyond the Rockies, it didn't work at all. And what that meant is that people that would try to homestead under those circumstances, if they didn't have access to irrigation, they died very quick. I mean, their activity diver.
Sure, and my grandfather, incidentally, was a dryland wheat farmer in the high prairies of Montana. So when there was rain, they did well, and when the rain went away,
right,
they went away too.
Well, what Powell argued, John Wesley Powell argued, was that we shouldn't be just setting up these grids. What we should be doing is discovering where the water is, where it could be transported feasibly, and then setting up counties, setting up political jurisdictions according to how the water was available.
Ah.
And that policy was never followed, as a matter of fact. Instead, the policy was to just do the surveys, get the rectangles set and get people out there as fast as possible, and if they perished economically, it was tough.
Sure. So those that were lucky enough to land on water and homestead the water got the land, and those who homesteaded the sagebrush had to move on eventually.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And what that did is that it then encouraged the process of expanding land ownership. So land ownership got to be much larger, let's say, in the far west than in the Midwest, especially the eastern part of the Midwest. Now, that's a matter of government policy. And the government was not really very sensible about that. And Powell's orientation would have made a great deal more sense if you wanted to, so to speak, people the land and have it really economically viable and sustaining relatively small units of production. Powell said in certain areas you needed not 160 acres, but if you were irrigating, 40 acres would have been sufficient. But for if you didn't have water, over 2,000 acres was insufficient. And you had to have units of it over 2,000. So it was a matter of shall you do the surveying and the analysis first, and then people...
Or just throw the people out.
Or just let the people go out and see what happens.
Yeah. And the government said, let the people go forth and figure out how to do this for us.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. What happened to us, to our government, that we pursue these giant economies rather than the smaller ones? What did our government tell us? How did our government provide direction for that?
Well, that's one of the processes that leads ultimately to the globalization phenomenon that we're involved with now, and that is the United States government and many other governments take the attitude that if you get economies of scale operative, then what happens is certain groupings, certain areas, certain nations become experts in doing certain different kinds of things, and therefore everybody benefits. Now, there's a certain amount of legitimacy to that argument, but at the same time, there are tremendous social costs that have to be paid.
Okay, when we get back from this break, I want to ask the professor about the costs. What are we paying for these benefits? And which leads me to my basic notion of life that cheap food isn't. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space, or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Hey, we're back. We're here in the studio cooking up 100 more stories with Professor William Friedland, who is a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Professor Friedland, we're talking a little bit about the costs of this pursuit of economies. On the one hand, we get cheaper food, but on the other hand, there are some costs to be paid. What are those costs?
Well, one of the costs, of course, is the process of urbanization. Now, urbanization does not just involve movement of people from agriculture to industry or to the city. Lots of people move into the United States. Some of them move into agriculture, but most of them don't go into agriculture.
Most go to the cities.
That's right. But when you have the depopulation that has taken place in the Midwest, most of those people just go into the cities. So that's a cost. The shift of the African-American population from the Deep South, where most of that population was concentrated for decades after the Civil War,
right.
Most of those people moved into urban areas. So they have to survive in urban circumstances, and that means that urban political leaders have to deal with those kinds of issues. So that's another kind of consequence. There are other consequences as well. I mean, one of the advantages of having relatively small units of agricultural production is that you have a potential human resource which is being, quotes, stored, unquotes, on the land rather than in the city. So that has environmental consequences because small units of production, people who usually work those pieces of land, know their land more intimately, let's say, than somebody who's sitting in Los Angeles and owns 40,000 acres.
Right.
And who hires various other kinds of people to actually do work on the land. And
then this pursuit, this never-ending pursuit of economies of scale is leading us to, really, to the globalization of our food because, you know, it's just simply a matter of fact that it's often much cheaper to grow things elsewhere than it is here. What impact, you know, can a society that relies on somebody else to feed it survive as a society?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, that's what the ultimate logic of this global division of labor produces. For one thing, see, for example, in Japan, there's been concern about
they fought this forever.
Food security with respect to rice. Now, one reason for that is that Japan was moving in the direction of importing increasing amounts of rice.
From California farmers.
That's right. And it then led to political tensions within Japan, and the policy for a period of time was to support Japanese production of rice.
Right.
Now, there was never any question that California rice could be delivered cheaper in Japan than Japanese rice. There was never any question about that. But it was a matter of food security.
Right.
Well, the pressure was put on the Japanese, and they kept on bringing in not only more rice, but also soybeans. And then, I've forgotten the year, but I think it was during the Nixon presidency, we ran into a problem. And that is the Russians started buying up enormous quantities of soybeans and rice and other American commodities, which then started raising the price of those commodities here at home. So we started getting political repercussions at home. And the result was that the Japanese suddenly found themselves vulnerable because they couldn't get the rice and soybeans from the United States.
So this internationalization, this really works until it really doesn't work anymore, and then.
That's right. One of the examples of this was that at one stage, some of the tremendously large agribusiness companies that deal with basic commodities like corn and wheat and soybeans, etc., proposed, these are American corporations mostly, proposed that they start importing some of these commodities from Argentina.
We're out of gas, Professor Friedland. I'm so sorry. I could go on like this forever. Folks, this has been The Food Chain with Michael Olson, Professor William Friedland from the University of California, Santa Cruz. More at www.metroforum.com on the forum. Do stay tuned. Thank you all so much. And remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.